Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on Member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips to BC. It is Saturday, the 22nd of September, Anno Domini 2012. Happy birthday, Bilbo Baggins, and you, you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Here's Dave Enright.
No, I just got to interrupt for 1 second. And thank all the folks that showed up for my birthday, even though Rob labeled it the one jazz.
I know. What was he thinking?
Yeah, for what? 400 people showed up?
Yeah.
Your birthday.
Yeah, the day after my birthday. Yeah.
It was and I just want to thank all the folks. We had a number of folks. That's why I wanted to interject here. We had a number of folks come up from Soundbites.
Very nice. Yep.
And talk and say, really enjoy your show. You know, thank you. I learned something new. You know, not every week, but he says, you're very entertaining. So, you know, just all the folks that showed up, and I hope they had a great
time. Yeah, I apologize to everybody. I was working, and unfortunately.
Well, you know, hey, life gets in the way sometimes, and you got to do what you got to do. But it was spectacular. We sold out.
Nice.
Yep.
Sold out. It was a.
I've enjoyed every year I've gone to. I love it. It's
great
a great,
food.
Great time.
Oh, I think folks are going to even the ones that didn't have their tickets right away and had. They're going to be getting them soon, earlier for next year's.
Yeah, get them early. Buy early and often.
Yep, there you
go. Chicago style of buying your tickets. All right. Friday, Microsoft released an emergency patch for Internet Explorer to stymie active attacks that have been exploiting a bug in the browser, finishing a job it started only Monday. The update, labeled MS-12-063, fixed 5 flaws, including one revealed by a security researcher last weekend that hackers have been using to infect Windows PCs with malware. The so-called zero-day vulnerability, meaning it was leveraged by attackers before Microsoft was aware of the bug, much less able to patch it, surfaced 6 days ago. The fix-it, as Microsoft calls them, the fix-it, relied on a tactic Microsoft first deployed in January 2011 when it used a shim, or application compatibility workaround, to thwart then-circulating attacks against IE. Then, as in the recent fix-it, Microsoft utilized the application compatibility toolkit, included with Windows since XP, to modify the core library of IE in memory every time the browser ran, which is really a pretty cool use of the technology. Users who have already enabled the shim do not have to uninstall it or disable the fix-it when they patch, Microsoft said. Today, Friday's update was rated critical by Microsoft, the company's highest threat rating. Of the 4 non-zero-day vulnerabilities, 3 were limited to IE, the 9, the edition that debuted in March of 2011. The 4th had an impact only on IE7 and IE8. All 5 vulnerabilities patched by MS-12-063, including the zero-day, were tagged as critical. Security experts said that Microsoft had this update sans the patch for the zero-day ready already, and failing the hustle to fix the exploited vulnerability, it would have been amongst those delivered next patch Tuesday, October 9th. What we're seeing is next month's patch. Given that the 4 others were all responsibly disclosed, they don't present that much of a threat. The other patch bars really were par for the course for IE. MS-12-063 applies to all supported editions of Windows, XP, Vista, and Windows 7, and affects IE6, IE7, IE8, and IE9. Only IE10, the browser that is bundled with Windows 8, is immune. So, our poll of the week at Soundbites.
Too bad Windows 8 isn't out yet.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons it's immune. Well, actually, you can get the preview thing, the 90-day preview.
Yeah, free
thing.
Preview, yeah.
So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. Microsoft's special patch for IE, and your choices are, I've already installed it, I'll get to it soon, go in commando, baby, and IE what now? So far, we've had 33 votes, and IE what now is ahead with 55%, 33% of you have already installed it, 12% are going commando, and absolutely nobody's going to get to it soon. So when you're done with the poll, I know you have more to say, so check the yellow box underneath the poll. Click on Give Us Your Opinion. It will take you to my website, AskNick.com.
That's AskNick.com.
Where you the question is, how do you feel about yet another zero-day vulnerability? And, of course, that's our question to you. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Operator is standing by.
Yes, I am.
Yes, he is. it's interesting.
All one of me.
Yeah, all one of you. As an operator,
that's why he had operator, singular.
Yeah, operator is standing by. It's interesting to me that so many zero-day exploits are coming to light now. A zero-day exploit, as I said in the news, is an exploit that's being used out in the wild even before the manufacturer of the product knows there's a problem. So this one was against Microsoft's Internet Explorer, so Microsoft did not know about this hole ahead of time. And those are the worst kind. In a lot of cases, people do know about them. They actually know that there's an issue somewhere. And, wow, I have not seen whiteout probably since the 80s.
Quite a while,
80s. Huh? Mickey Dolenz's mother actually created whiteout. Mickey yep. Dolenz of the Monkees. But the zero-day exploit, you know, it's easy enough to patch an exploit you know has happened. Of course, yep. Microsoft only does that once a month, but that's a different problem. But to be hit with an exploit you didn't even know was out there. There are a lot of people looking at a lot of products and looking for holes. And those are the ones who find these zero-day exploits. You know, you can't really blame Microsoft any more than you can blame any of the other companies that are out there. The reality is nobody's got the money to put, at least they don't put the money. You can argue whether they have the money, but they don't put the money into, you know, thousands of people sitting around looking at code trying to find holes. Whereas,
and the market pressure of ship now and get your product out.
Exactly. And so rather than get it out right, they get it out now. And that causes the problem of things like zero-day vulnerabilities. And everybody's guilty of it. I don't know of any code that doesn't have a vulnerability. There's a lot of code out there that nobody's looking for vulnerabilities in, like, you know, small apps and things like that. Nobody cares if you've got an alarm clock app. Nobody's
yeah.
really looking for exploits in that.
Yep.
But if that doesn't mean they aren't there.
See, Mike, Dave just turned his mic off, and your mic sounds a whole lot better in my earpiece now.
Sure.
That's weird.
That is weird.
The other thing that we've seen, and you've got a story later on, is that there's a lot of security shows that happen around the world, and there are bounties for finding bugs no one knows about.
Right.
So some of there's good guys, the white hats, the bad guys, the black hats, and then there's the gray hats in the middle.
Right.
Some of them will keep a hole they find secret until the next show comes so they can win whatever the prize is. Most of the good guys who find security holes report it to the company and then let the company fix it before it's made public.
That's why companies like Google have bounties.
Yeah.
And they're not just during the show. They're all the time.
Yeah.
So if you find a hole in a Google product, any Google product, you tell Google, they give you money. And it's thousands of dollars, depending on the product.
733, no, LEET.
It's LEET.
Yeah.
7337.
Yeah.
No, not 7, 1, 1337. But yeah, it's a serious incident. That's happened this time. And so if you have not patched your Internet Explorer, it doesn't matter what version of Windows you're using. It's XP, it hits Vista, and if any of you are still using Vista, you deserve it, and Windows 7. So if any of those versions, if you use Internet Explorer, and oh, by the way, if
20 grand. Google has rewards up to 20 grand
yep.
for the most serious bugs.
And oh, by the way, if you use Outlook Express, you are using Internet Explorer, even if it's not your browser of choice, because Microsoft uses it to show you, uses the same code yes. as Internet Explorer, pulls in the same libraries to yep. Show you HTML mail. I'm sorry, is there something
no,
more important? No,
I was going to say there's something weird going in the board. You just turned your mic back on, and Nick's just went weird again.
Well, I didn't know if you guys were talking to me because I wasn't paying attention.
I know, yeah. You weren't.
That's why I was going to wait for Nick to finish.
I've lost my train of thought. Doesn't matter anymore. Anyway, let's move on. Our next caller is
Linda. No, you were saying about the vulnerability.
I honestly don't remember. Let's move on. Linda from Greece. Hi, Linda. What's up?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I got a question. Remember I called maybe several weeks ago and I was talking about Gmail and the all mail folder?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of my friends said to me, you know you can get rid of the all-mail folder. And I said, I can do what? And he says, yeah. He says, I got rid of it. And he started telling me how to do this, going to the Gmail lab. I didn't understand what he was talking about.
Well, you don't ever get rid of the all-mail folder.
But
you can hide it.
So you don't see it anymore.
Yeah, because I went into the all-mail folder. I have got 2,000 emails, and I'm thinking to myself, how the heck did I get 2,000 emails stored in there?
Because it's all your mail. If you've put mail in folders, it shows up in there, too.
And all
if you've thrown mail in the trash and haven't emptied the trash, it shows up in there, too. Linda, you're obsessing about this all mail folder. Ignore it. Leave it alone. Don't pay any attention to it.
But I mean, you know, so in other words, I could have 10,000 in there and Google won't mind?
No, Google doesn't care.
Oh, okay.
You should every once in a while empty your trash, but that's just for your own sake.
Yeah, that's
true. I empty my trash, but I thought to myself, oh, so don't worry about the all-mail folder. Okay.
Yeah, you have 10, what is it, 10 gig or
gigs.
5 gig?
10
gigs.
10 gigs now.
You have 10 gigs for your mail. If you look at the bottom of your main screen, you'll see how much you've used. You probably haven't even used 1 gig. You probably haven't used half a gig.
Okay, because he said to me, well, you got to get rid of it. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to do anything until I talk to the guy.
Yeah, if you do want to hide it, you can do that. That's certainly a doable thing.
How do I do that?
Your friend there was right.
It's under settings somewhere.
Yeah.
Settings, labels. Yeah, settings, labels, you can hide. No, I can't. I can't hide my all mail.
No, you have to. It's not.
Oh, it's already hidden, so I can show it. So you log into your gmail.com webpage.
Okay.
And then you go to the little gear icon, which is your settings.
Right.
And then under settings, you go to labels.
Uh-huh.
And then you can show or hide your inbox, your chat box, your sent box, your all mail box.
Oh.
So you can hide those things if you don't want to see them anymore. So and the other thing the all mail contains is all the spam and all the sent mail. So it literally is all the mail that's ever come through your system.
Wow.
Including lots of mail you probably never saw because it was junk.
Yeah. Wow.
So you can hide those. They call them labels instead of mailboxes.
Yeah.
Some programs call them mail folders or mailboxes. Google calls them labels.
Okay. I got one more question if you can. Okay. On Gmail, if I go into Gmail on my computer, I see, because I brought everything from Yahoo over to Gmail, I see one label for important, one label for this. But if I go into on my iPad, I see two labels that say important and all that. How come I only see one on my computer but two on my iPad?
What it's probably doing is it's... The two sections are the mail that's on your iPad and the mail that's on the Google server.
Ah.
So it's probably showing you that separately because some of the mail you download to your computer or your iPad,
uh-huh.
And then the rest of it stays on the Google server so that it doesn't have to download it all to the iPad because of the limited disk space on the iPad.
Yeah, because when I had Yahoo Mail, I had an important folder, but since I moved it all over here, now I've got two important folders.
Right. One is probably the old stuff. Are they in exactly the same place, or in the two little separate sections?
No. They're one right underneath each other.
Okay. One of them is probably the old stuff, and the other is the new stuff, or it's just duplicated because, as Steve said, some of the mail has downloaded so that you can view it offline.
Yeah. So I should just leave it there and not get rid of it.
Yeah, just ignore it.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Sure.
Google tries to decide what important mail is based on your address book and who you've emailed before so that it puts it to the top of your email box or in that separate important folder.
Yep. It's a... Yeah, I don't know. I use Gmail for most of my stuff, but I do it through Thunderbird, so I don't usually go into the Gmail web thing, and that's fine one way or the other. But it's good to know it's there because I can certainly. I use Gmail, the Gmail app on my Nexus tablet and on my phone. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, like I said, I don't usually go into the.
Well, that was one of the things on the Thunderbird blog when they said they're going to stop developing future versions of Thunderbird. Is so many people use web-based email, and so many people have mobile devices that running a mail program on a computer is actually declining enough.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. This is a great story. Samsung plans to add the iPhone 5 to existing patent lawsuits against Apple, stepping up its legal challenge to Apple as the two smartphone leaders seek to assert rights to key technologies. The fresh legal step comes as Apple booked orders for over 2 million iPhone 5s in the first 24 hours of its availability. Samsung and Apple are locked in patent battle in 10 countries, and the stakes are high as the two vie for top spot in the booming smartphone market. Both companies are also raising marketing spending to promote their latest products ahead of the crucial year-end holiday season. Samsung anticipates that it will file in the near future a motion to amend its infringement contentions to add the iPhone 5 as an accused product, the company said in a U.S. court filing. An accused product. They continued, based on information currently available, Samsung expects that the iPhone 5 will infringe the asserted Samsung patents in suit in the same way as the other accused iPhone models, Samsung said. Apple continues to make aggressive legal measures that will limit market competition. Under these circumstances, we have little choice but to take the steps necessary to protect our innovations and intellectual property rights. Apple Korea reiterated that its position was that it's the victim of copying, not vice versa. At Apple, we value originality and innovation. We make these products to delight our customers, not for our competitors to flagrantly copy. Apple scored a victory over Samsung in late August when a U.S. jury found the Korean firm had copied critical features of the iPhone, you know, like rounded corners, those are critical, and awarded the U.S. firm $1.05 billion in damages. The jury also found that Apple did not infringe any of Samsung's asserted patents. Apple has since vowed it would continue the fight. Apple's victory was also a blow to Google, whose Android software powers the Samsung products that were found to infringe Apple patents. Actually, only two things, and one of them was pinched to zoom. Samsung, the biggest Android maker, received a second U.S. legal setback last week when a judge at the International Trade Commission said in a preliminary ruling that Apple did not violate patents owned by Samsung. The Korean firm was the world's first top smartphone maker in the second quarter of 2012, shipping more than 50 million phones, nearly double Apple's 26 million iPhone shipments. So are you as tired of this nonsense as we are? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll-free 1-800-790-0415, just like Bill did from Greece, New York. Hiya, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, good morning, fellas. Good
morning.
I have a Dell running the Windows 7, and when I first power up, I get this message. It says, this application has requested the runtime to terminate in an unusual way. Please contact your application support team for more information. I just get it as it powers up, and after that, I don't get it again.
It should tell you what application it is.
Yeah, I've got it right in front of me. It says, just terminate the application in an unusual way.
Well, is there a title in the...
Okay, it says Microsoft Visual C++.
Okay, so that's...
Library.
Yeah, that's the application that's trying to run something at startup.
Okay.
That could be, honestly, any one of 100 gazillion things, but... it could be a virus. Have you danced the Security Tango?
No, the computer's in, well, no, I haven't.
And you probably should. It is a C++ message, and it's clearly a program being run by something.
Mm-hmm.
And the question becomes what? So if you dance the Security Tango, and it doesn't find any problems, then you know that it's just some program that a legitimate program that you've installed, and then you've got some detective work to do to figure out which one.
You can try going through your startup items folder and see what's in there, and then deleting things you don't need anymore. So sometimes it's a leftover program, you know, like you installed a printer, which installed a utility to communicate with the printer, and then say you uninstalled the printer driver, well, it might have left that little utility behind. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to run and can't because it's been uninstalled. And that's one of the main annoyances with the Windows Uninstaller is it doesn't uninstall everything.
Right. So if your best bet is to start with the Security Tango.
Okay.
At securitytango.com. And see if that finds anything. That's really, when you have an error message like that, it's probably your best bet to start there.
Mm-hmm. I did Google it to find out, and somebody mentioned something about they had that problem after they loaded Windows Office.
Again, it's very possible, but if I were you, I would absolutely start with
Dancing.
Yeah, so many programs use those Visual C++ libraries that it's almost impossible to know which one it actually is without looking through them all to try to find out.
Right, and as Archandra in the IRC chat says, it's possible it's a versioning problem. The application wants version X, but the system found version Y, because something updated and something else didn't. Did this start after an update? Okay. Check against viruses first.
Okay. All right.
And then, as Steve said, check in your startup folder or msconfig to see what's starting at startup. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one at a time, take them out until the error goes away.
Okay, I'll try that.
Okie doke.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye.
This is the worst part of pretty much any of these things is that troubleshooting part, that detective work.
Yeah.
Because it takes forever. You have to try one thing, try the next thing, try the next thing.
And especially things in msconfig are often the 8-character DOS file name.
Yeah,
so you have no idea what it really is, so you uncheck it, and then suddenly your Ethernet doesn't work.
Right.
So it's very tricky to know what each one of those things does and if you really need them or not.
Right. And luckily, it's rare that you would stop something that actually caused Windows to not run anymore.
Right, yeah, no.
So you can always just go back in and turn it on again. The first thing I think to do is to just start up in safe mode and see if it doesn't happen.
Yeah, but it's a good way. Yeah. Well, you got to start somewhere, and it'd be, the safest.
Right. Well, I would actually start with the Security Tango, which also puts you in safe mode.
Yeah, so. That's...
Birds with one stone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very tough problem. We see it all the time, and the real problem is that the error messages are garbage, and they don't even tell you what program they're running in. Mm-hmm. And that's just laziness and or stupidity on the programmer's part. I'm sorry, but it's true. When you write error messages in a web program, you don't have to worry about it because it's the web program if it brings up an error message.
Right.
But if it's in your operating system, it could be any one of 50 programs. So identify yourself before you tell me the error message.
Well, I think that's the problem. The programmers are so thinking, you know, so narrow. It's, it's only my program. Yeah, it's an error. It's doing what I want it to do, throw up an error.
Yeah.
But they forget that there's plenty of other programs that could be also causing the issue.
Yep. So you get a bunch of programs that don't have any identification in them. And, of course, if you're actually the programmer, there's all kinds of debuggers and stuff you can run that will tell you what the program is. But the average user doesn't have that choice.
Yep.
Most of the time.
I like some of the cute error messages. There's one in Firefox. If it crashes, when you launch it again, it goes, well, this is embarrassing. I seem to have lost your tabs. Let me try to reload them now.
Yep. Chrome does much the same thing. Some very funny stuff. If a page dies, it throws up a He's Dead Jim page. All right, our next caller is Bill from Brighton, New York. Hi, Bill, what's up?
Nope, you read that wrong.
It's Henrietta from Brighton, New York.
Nope. Henry. Yeah.
Not yet.
It's Henry.
One more time.
Oh,
there you go.
Jesus, Craig. I'm going home now. No, you did it right. This is all about me, Dave.
Bill.
Yeah. Hi, welcome back. I'm Nick Francesca.
I'm David.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And we have Henry from Brighton on the line. Hiya, Henry. What's up?
How you doing? I recently started getting a program, apparently, coming up called Registry Booster.
What is it called again?
UniBlue. UniBlue. Registry Booster. and it's trying to get me to activate it. I never downloaded it even, and I'm kind of concerned that it's some Trojan horse or virus or certainly some malware. The thing is, I checked in under control panel under remove programs, and there's nothing in there that indicates that it's installed in any form, whether it's the application or the installer. I just want to get rid of it, and I checked on the internet. It seems that a number of other people have had problems with this popping up on their system.
Is it a web window popping up? Maybe it may have put something in your web startup, so it's actually opening a web window, not a window on your computer.
But yes, I think it only happens when I use Firefox, and I think it only happens when I'm running Firefox.
Yeah, it may have installed a cookie in your browser. It may have installed something in your homepage settings in your browser. It does seem to be a registry cleaner, but it looks just like a lot of the fake registry and virus cleaners that are out there. And most of the hits I'm getting are asking if it is malware or not.
Yeah,
there is a real one, but that doesn't mean this is it. And if you're only getting it when you run Firefox, I would suggest that it's somewhere. Is it when you first start Firefox?
Yes.
Or
I think it's when I first started, yes.
Okay, what it sounds like is there's been something installed, a JavaScript, somewhere in your machine.
Or it's a tab trying to restore.
It could be a tab trying to restore as well, yeah. I might suggest that the thing you really want to do is probably delete your cache.
Okay.
The cache is where stuff is saved, and so there will be JavaScript files in there that wherever you downloaded them, have flagged, keep these on the machine and run them all the time. So it might not be a bad idea to delete those at some point.
There may be a folder in your start menu called UniBlue. It may not have put itself in the control panels yet.
I believe I've checked that. Under programs, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding different hits about removing it, and it does seem to be pretty insidious in your system. It was probably an ad on a
website. I do see it in the start menu.
Yeah.
Under programs, yes.
It was probably an ad on a website you went to that installed itself. We sometimes call that a drive-by download.
Okay.
So you may be able to uninstall it from there, or download Revo Uninstaller. And it does a much better job of finding and uninstalling programs that get into the system.
Okay. All right.
And in addition, once you've uninstalled it with Revo, I would suggest that you also dance the security tango.
Go through that again, yeah.
Right, I'm sorry, but yeah.
I've used security tango. It's very good, but very time-consuming.
Very time-consuming. I absolutely agree with that. Also, it would not be a bad idea to delete your cache. Depending on which version of Firefox you're using, if you go into Preferences, if you go into Preferences under Advanced, then the Network tab, one of the choices is Cached Web Content, and you can say Clear Now, and also underneath that is Offline Web Content and User Data.
Yeah, well, the version of Firefox I have is 15.0.1.
Okay, well, but that's what you're looking for. Well, see, I'm using Linux, so it's a slightly different versioning system.
Okay.
But that's basically where it is and how it works. So, so whatever. Got it?
Okay, so it would be under Options is where I would find that for the trying to find where the cache would be.
Under Tools? Under Preferences, which in mine is under Edit.
There's no preferences. There's options, add-ons.
Okay, yes. Go over to edit. Under edit, can you find preferences?
There's no edit.
That should be next to the file menu.
No, right from the top level. on the same level as tools. If you looked at your menus, you have file, edit, view, history, bookmarks, tools, help.
No, Firefox doesn't have that. Firefox just has you go to the upper left-hand corner.
Oh, that new version.
Yeah, the new version doesn't turn on all those things, and you got to go in there and turn them on under view.
Oh, under view?
Yeah, under view.
You turn on those options all on.
The top-level menus are a required UI from Windows.
No, not under Windows anymore. Nope. Not under 7.
Nope.
Yeah.
One of the other suggestions I would make, and I'm doing this to all folks, you know, we realize dancing the security tango takes time. And like you say, once you've done it, you know, you sit there and wonder about doing it again. What I suggest to a lot of my customers is doing the, say, malware bytes or super anti-spyware, do them at night. Do one night, one the other night. And all you do is just before you're ready to turn in, you start the program, turn your monitor off, leave the computer on.
Yeah.
That way it goes ahead and it does its job. And you don't sit there waiting and waiting and waiting and saying, when's it going to get done? You wake up in the morning, come out, turn your computer on, you know, the monitor on. It's done its job, and you're keeping it clean. And if you keep doing that, you know, with those both of those programs, because your antivirus is going to run every night anyway, you're always checking.
It does, yeah.
So if you check those two programs, say, twice a week, if you're a big surfer, just turn it on, get it going, turn the monitor off, leave the system on, you're going to stay well protected.
Yeah, once you've run the security tango, the only time you have to run the whole thing is when something like what happened to you happens.
Yeah.
So on a regular basis, if you're not seeing some kind of wonky something going on, as Dave suggests, just do that and you should be good. Okay, we got to go.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 39 minutes after the hour, so there's still plenty of time to join us. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. We are the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve, next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbite. Dutch security researchers hacked an iPhone 4S on Wednesday, showing how a malicious web page can send all pictures, address book data, and browsing history on the phone to a server of the attacker's choice. As participants in the mobile pwn-to-own competition, they demonstrated the exploit to an audience at the EU SecWest Security Conference in Amsterdam. Their attack works on iOS 5.1.1 and the developer release of iOS 6, and so probably also works on the iPhone 5. They also said that it works on iPads. The WebKit browser exploit was made in only a few weeks, the researchers said, and we didn't even work full-time. Their exploit shows that limited time is needed to come up with a technique to exploit a security vulnerability in iOS. When a user visits a website where the code is running, the security mechanisms in Safari are circumvented. The code could be embedded in advertisements on news sites. As long as they can embed the code anywhere on a website, it will work. The researchers wouldn't reveal how the exploit works exactly. The researchers were curious what Apple thinks of the data leak. They said Apple will have to come up with an update, and then people need to upgrade as fast as possible. The researchers earned $30,000 for the exploit, among other prizes. So, do you worry about phone exploits? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415, just like Ed did from Ithaca, New York. Hi, Ed. How are things in Ithaca?
Well, it finally turned sunny.
Yay!
Yep.
I
have an older iMac running 10.3.9, and I wanted to have it be wireless capable. So I ordered something which I thought would just go into USB port, but it looks like it's internal, a little card that goes in the inside somehow. And so I don't know if that's something I could do myself, or if it's beyond an amateur's capability.
Well, it depends on which iMac and what kind of card it is.
Okay. Well, it's one of those white iMacs with the separate keyboard and mouse, but everything's in this flat screen.
Is it a G3, G4, or G5? So yeah, every model is different. Every model has different configurations. Some models are much easier to get into than other models.
Okay.
So, so probably the short answer is no. It's not something a user would be able to easily do.
Okay. It's a PowerMac G5.
Okay. Does it have a camera on it?
No.
That's one of the easier ones to get into. But there's two different kinds of cards it could be. The internal card, it's either an airport card or an airport extreme card. And that depends on exactly which model it is as to which type of card it needs.
I see.
Yeah, it's much easier to get an external USB card. And they're usually cheaper anyway. We carry them in our store for about $50.
Uh-huh. Okay. The hardware says airport card but on the system profile, but no information found.
Because you don't have an airport card in the computer, yeah.
It would be just a regular airport card rather than a...
I don't know.
Oh.
It depends on exactly what model it is.
Well, since it's not in the machine, you can't look at the machine to find out what it is.
Uh-huh.
You have to look up in the specs of the machine, which I'm trying to get my spec page to open, to see what kind of card it takes. What kind of card did you get? It should say on it whether it's an airport card or airport extreme card.
Okay, let me...
The airport cards are physically bigger. The extreme cards are a little bit smaller.
Let me open the package here. It says extreme.
Okay. So that may not be the right card.
Uh-huh.
Remind me later. So the original iMac G5, 17-inch or 20-inch?
Probably
it's different. Yeah, it's different for each model.
You want fries with that?
Yeah.
So the short answer is you need to take it to somebody.
Okay.
Really, because you may not even have the right version.
G5, 17-inch, without the camera, uses an airport extreme card.
Okay, so that's correct.
So, yeah, the user's manual probably tells you how to open the computer because it's the same for installing RAM. There may be even the instructions for installing the airport extreme card as well.
Okay.
In the card, with the card itself.
And in the original user's manual, which
right.
is probably long gone.
We probably still have it.
Yeah,
there you go,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's more convenient to have that internal card because then you don't have something sticking out the back. And then it uses the Apple drivers and you don't have to load third-party drivers.
Right.
But it's often less expensive to do the external USB one.
Yeah, I'm looking at the computer. The only thing I see are some screws on the bottom.
Yeah, there's three screws on the bottom and the whole back panel comes off.
Oh, okay. So yep. That part is relatively simple then. You don't need special tools for that.
It's a regular Phillips screwdriver, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yep.
Very good.
The ones with the camera are a lot harder to get off because they changed it, so now you have to take the front glass off, then you take the front bezel off, then you take the LCD off, then you can get to the guts of the computer.
Fine.
We really like that iMac G5. What we read at the time, these models came out in August of 2004, it was intended to be user serviceable, like Dells and Compacts of the time, where you'd call up Apple and they would say, oh, yeah, you need this part, and they'd send it to you. So it's easy to get the back off, and then there's large modules for replacing the parts. Apparently, more and more people broke the machines because you can't have inexperienced users tinkering around inside their electronic devices. So we ended up at our shop seeing a lot of computers come in broken, where Apple tried to talk someone through over the phone on how to replace a part on the inside, and that doesn't work hardly at all. But it was easy to get into for us to service, and we liked that.
Right. Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Sure. All right, thank you.
Bye.
That's an... it used to be, back in the day, you'd get an IBM computer or an IBM clone.
Yeah.
And they were all identical inside. So if you bought a card, you knew it fit in there.
Well, unless it was an ISA card, an ESA card, a PCI card. Yeah.
In the original, it was just the
ISA. The original one, yeah. The original ISA card, yeah.
Right. And so a lot of people did a lot of their own maintenance. Also, let's don't forget that in many cases that was... hobbyists were buying these things,
right.
So they were used to taking
and you wanted to tinker with it.
That's exactly right.
It's like buying a car today. You can't tinker with your car anymore. The computer's underneath. You open the hood, and there's nothing accessible. You can barely change your own spark plugs.
Well, that's exactly right. And nowadays, the people who buy desktops are really in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
People are either buying laptops, which, again, you can change the hard drive. Maybe you can add RAM, certainly. But that's pretty close to it.
Yep.
Or you've bought, if you're buying Macs, They're all in ones. Tablets you can't do a lot with.
Yep.
Certainly not the iPad. Some Apple, some Android tablets you can do stuff with. Phones, an Apple phone, you can't even change the battery. At least I can do that in my phone. But other than that, nothing.
Yeah, you can still get the Apple Tower that opens up like a regular tower and all the slots are in it.
Right.
But very, very few people are doing. And there's rumors that Apple, that hasn't been updated in a couple of years.
Right.
And there's rumors Apple's going to kill it because the sales are so low to not bother. There's a very small market of people that need a high-end tower like that.
Right, and that's exactly the problem. What happens with those people?
Yeah.
I have a friend who is a documentarian. And he comes
home. Yeah, it's videographers,
right,
mostly.
He's got multi terabyte arrays on his tower, which he needs for video editing. Where does he go when he can't get a new one?
Thunderbolt external RAID.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Frank from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Frank. What's your question?
Hi. My first question, I got a bunch of them, but my first question is, do you guys offer any training classes or workshops?
For what?
For, you know, anything on computers and understanding it or, you know, questioning. Every time I take a class, it's always been so basic it bored me to death. Is there an intermediate class somewhere?
You might want to check your, you're in Rochester?
I'm in Irondequoit, actually.
Well, Irondequoit offers a number. As a matter of fact, the book just came out for all the classes that they're offering.
Too boring.
You'll
too
find,
boring.
Yeah, most of the classes that I've seen in community centers and continuing ed through the local high schools, things like that, they're either very, very basic or they're too advanced. There's some...
JCC is another one.
JCC is another
good one. JCC offers a wide variety of courses.
And there's also commercial...
local users groups.
Local users groups, yep.
That provide all kinds of stuff. And, of course, as Steve was about to say...
There's commercial training centers, but they're generally geared toward businesses. And, you know, $1,000 a day for training is common. I used to teach some of those classes. And it's just...
You didn't get the $1,000
right.
a day.
I taught a Photoshop class, and the first day was how to select things. The thousands of different ways you select things. Then the second day was how to change and edit what you selected. And I had a couple of people at the first break of the day. So when are we going to learn how to use Photoshop? You are. You have to know how to select a little bit of thing you want to change.
Right.
And that was interesting.
Right. People don't want to go through the basics.
Yeah.
I get it.
But a lot of times if you look at continuing... Yeah, look at the continuing ed centers. If there's a town hall, town rec center. I know where I live in Parenton. They have a real big rec center. They publish their catalogs of the classes they teach. And often you'll see beginner, intermediate, and advanced type classes there as well.
Uh-huh. Okay. My next question is these flash drives. I got 25 of them. Do they take up a lot of room? Should I keep using them, or should I stop using them? Or how many can a computer hold?
What? Flash drives are the things you plug into the USB port, right?
Yeah, but they need drivers.
Well, what version of Windows are you running?
Vista.
Yeah, it's all one driver.
It's all one driver.
The USB mass storage driver.
Unless you've got a really, really unusual flash drive.
Uh-huh.
They all use the same driver, so once you've loaded the driver, you're done.
Yeah, but it says doesn't recognize it and installing your device and all this other stuff.
That's just part of Vista.
That's a Vista problem.
Yeah,
it always has been.
Vista was, how can I politely say it?
You can't.
Junk. Yeah. From day one, it ranks right up there as far as I'm concerned as Windows ME and the soon to be released Windows 8.
Yeah, it takes quite a few seconds, you know, sometimes 10-20 seconds for Windows to recognize that you plugged in a USB drive and to load the USB mass storage drivers.
So Windows 7 is going to be better than Windows 8 then.
I'm advising folks right now, if you have Windows XP, Windows Vista, go up to Windows 7.
Stay there.
Yeah, unless you want to learn a whole new operating system, because Windows 8 is going to be a big paradigm shift for most users.
It's a tablet OS they're forcing on desktop users, basically.
Yeah.
And let me put it as simply as possible. You would find it easier to switch to Linux or a Mac than to go to Windows 8.
Yep. I thoroughly agree with you 100%.
If I were to put, if you were to use Windows 8 for about 3 weeks, and I came over and put Linux on your machine instead, you would kiss me, beard and all.
Can you be sitting there telling Nick, oh, thank you for bringing back my old Windows?
Yep. Yep.
Where's your shop located anyway?
Well, you can find all kinds of information on our website at soundbites.org. There's links at the top, pictures of the various places that you can check out for any of that stuff. Okie doke.
Okay, now on file systems, what's the difference between CDFS and a UDF file system?
Why? Are you given a choice?
Well, no, I'm not given a choice, but I've noticed that when I have a CD with a CDF file system, I can't add data to it.
Right. That's the point. Yeah, CDs are write-only. Some types of CDs you can erase and write to again. Those are usually called RW disks. But the CD file system was basically designed that way.
I see. And that's what it stands for, CD file system, right?
Right.
And what's the UDF? Universal?
Universal disk format or disk file system, something like that. It's a newer file system. So it's like FAT32, well, FAT and then FAT16, FAT32, and then NTFS were the file systems that generally mature into something new. On the Mac side, we had MFS and HFS. There's a new one that shows a lot of promise called ZFS from Sun that you can plug a hard drive in and it just automatically adds to the size of your C drive. So you plug another hard drive in and it automatically just adds to the size of your C drive. It's a really, really interesting concept. Sometimes that's called a JBOD, just a bunch of disks.
You're right.
But the computer researchers are always trying to come out with newer and better disk file systems, and it's takes a lot to change the file system in your OS because oftentimes it makes incompatible all of the old stuff. When Windows went to NTFS, originally in Windows NT, it was, what, 10, 15 years before it really became the default? I think Windows Vista was the first one to use NTFS by default.
Yep. Yeah, so there's a lot of technical reasons that they're different, but generally speaking, the basic difference is the way it was originally written. Frank, we got to go.
Okay.
Thanks. We are going to take a break, but we will be back for a whole nother hour of this nonsense, and it's really easy to join in with us. All you really need to do is call 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll free at 1-800-790-0415. And we will be back in another hour with a whole lot more of Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. And for no discernible reason, you've just lived through an hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. So get set for another hour. Brace yourselves. We are Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And let me do this. Oh, this is a great one. Facebook. It's the return of Facebook. Facebook's ongoing war on pseudonyms is well documented. The company wants everyone to use their real name on the social network. And ideally, this would be their only identity on the whole internet. Because, you know, Facebook is the center of the internet. Facebook often bans users that use fake names. Most are spammers, but many are just using pseudonyms. But it recently went further than that. The company is now asking you to snitch on your friends if they are not using their real name. Facebook recently started prompting friends of users with names they suspect to be fake. The text of the prompt is, please help us understand how people are using Facebook. Your response is anonymous and won't affect your friend's account. Is your friend's name real? Then you have four options to choose from. Yes, no, I don't know, and I don't want to answer. There is no X in the top right corner to close the prompt.
You have to answer.
There is, however, a link to the company's name policy, which includes the following question and answer. Why doesn't Facebook allow fake names? Facebook is a community where people connect and share using their real identities. When everyone uses their real first and last names, people can know who they're connecting with. This helps keep our community safe. We take the safety of our community very seriously. That's why we remove fake accounts from the site as we find them. Facebook has a point that using real names is a good way to keep its users safe. Unfortunately, it may also endanger them. Many Facebook users opt to use pseudonyms to hide from stalkers, abusive exes, and even governments that don't condone free speech. Yes, these people are breaking Facebook's terms of service. Yes, the company certainly needs a way to enforce said rules. No, I don't think asking friends to snitch is the right way to go about it. Do you think snitching on your friends is a great idea? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Wait a minute. I could go on and say that I'm William Miller, say.
Sure.
That's a real name.
But it's not your real name.
How would they know that it's not?
That's true. They don't. What they suspect is somebody who, you know, bills him or herself as Grand Dark Overlord of the Universe.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But you're absolutely right. If you've got a pseudonym because you have an abusive ex or a stalker, I don't really want to be outed by my friends who say, no, the real name is such and such. I think that's not right. I think
right.
Google Plus does much the same thing.
Yeah, when Facebook originally started, most of them were pseudonyms.
Right.
And then when Google started their Google Plus, there was a real big uproar from people who wanted to use a synonym because people have, you know, gamer tags or nicknames that they've been known for years. And now I can't be, you know, Junior on Google because people have been calling me Junior for 20 years.
Well, you can have an also known as.
Yeah.
But that's secondary. And it's an interesting problem. Facebook has Mark Zuckerberg, who, as you know, runs Facebook, has famously said there is no privacy on the Internet. He doesn't believe in privacy for Facebook. Facebook was the first company to use a super cookie. So if you actually used Google on your machine, it saved a cookie that would overwrite other cookies and give Facebook access to other places you went on the Internet. Facebook now has a product that when you use your I don't know that they've actually implemented it yet, but they were certainly talking about it on a number of the security things that I read. If you actually load the new Facebook app on your system, they show you ads. We all know that. Facebook will now show you their ads when you're running other apps. They figured out a way to get into other apps. It works on both Android and Apple. iOS.
That's really annoying.
And so, you know, if you buy a product, for example, so that you don't see the ads, you can still see ads now. I don't use Facebook on my phone. I don't use Facebook on my tablet. And when I run it on my computer, I run it on an entirely different browser. As far as I know, there are no cross-browser cookies. So I'm still a little bit safe at least. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Greece, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
My question centers around backing up your PC. And it's really kind of a three-part question. Part A being online backup services such as Carbonite or one of the others. Good, bad, or, you know, there's preferred ways of doing it. So that's really part A. part B on the question is, if you're going to back up locally to one of these external hard drives that you could plug into the USB, is there a preferred hard drive backup, being RAID, mirroring, or you do something more direct? And the final and third part, how do you know what's a good hard drive? Where do you go to read reviews around really understanding what a good hard drive might be for its reliability and performance?
From my end of the point of view is, well, as far as offsite, I love Google Drive. I use that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as programs and what you're going to back up, the only thing I tell folks to worry about backing up is their user folder.
Their own documents.
Yeah, of their own documents, because usually that has your documents, any pictures or anything else. So if you're grabbing that folder, you've got everything that you need. Because if your system crashes or it gets infected, you know, you're going to wipe it and reinstall all those programs over again anyways, and maybe even clean out some old stuff that wasn't there. As far as hard drives, now if you're talking just... you know, a nice compact one, you know, it's a 2.5-inch drive, say Toshiba or Western Digital are good hard drives. They usually have good warranties. Seagate is another one.
Yeah,
three manufacturers usually have at least a 1-year, if not a 3-year warranty on some of them.
And those are the only three manufacturers left because they've all been bought, buying up everybody else. But you'll often see that even within a drive manufacturer, there'll be a cheap version with, say, a 1-year warranty. And there'll be a good version with, say, a 3 or 5 year warranty. Sometimes they call them personal use and enterprise class. A lot of times, what we recommend in our shop, we like the LaCie brand because it's sort of in the middle, and they typically use Seagate mechanisms. They let you back up everything on your computer, and then some people will have several of them. Several different backup drives so that you take it offsite yourself, or you can use an online service to have an offsite backup. Because it's you want to have a backup period, but then say there's a fire or flood in your house and your computer and the backup drive sitting right next to it is both lost. That's why you want to have that offsite backup as well.
Yeah, Carbonite is another good one. That's a commercial one. So any one of those is generally pretty nice, but I'm a belt and suspenders guy. I believe in backing up in more than one place. So I back up both to a local hard drive on my network that's not in my machine but is on my network, and to a server out on the internet. That way I've got a quick restore locally if I need it, but I've also got a separate backup somewhere else. And again, to reiterate what Dave originally said, you really want to make sure that you are storing all of your stuff in your documents folder. And then you only have to back up the documents folder. Mail is a separate issue, but as more and more people move to web-based mail, that becomes no problem at all. Yeah, I let Google back up my mail.
Bingo.
I don't even care.
Yep.
Your mail folder is usually an invisible folder in my documents, so it often gets that anyway. It's hard to get back sometimes, but at least it's backing up.
Right.
So and then there's sort of two general sides. You want to have, if you want it to be easy, you can get an automated backup program, something like Carbonite for offsite backup, or what is it, Cobain backup for Windows.
Cobain.
On the Mac, there's Time Machine built into the Mac to do automatic backup. And then some people like to do more manual backups where they copy the folders they know they want to back up onto a flash drive or onto a network drive. Nick has an rsync script that sends it to a server somewhere. And
exactly right.
So, you can be as easy or as complex as you want to be.
It depends on how important the data is to you. And that's where you're going to take either the time or effort to do this due diligence, like Nick said, and, you know, making sure that if it's really vital and if, you know, this stuff is lost, it's going to be, catastrophic for you, that you do it, like you said, Nick said, you know, on your machine somewhere and then off site.
We hear a lot of horror stories from customers that bring in drives, especially in these days of digital cameras where you don't have negatives anymore. And then, you know, my hard drive failed and I lost all the baby pictures and my wife is going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we can recover the data, But more often than not, you end up with a commercial data recovery service. We use one called DriveSavers.
Yep.
And you're looking at $1,000 minimum to get your drive recovered. They have a spacesuit.
That's minimum, by the way.
Spacesuit, clean room. They literally take the drive apart, look at it with an electron microscope. And so a 1 terabyte drive has 8 trillion little pieces of rust on it that are either pointing north and south or south and north, and they look at them one by one and reconstruct your data.
If you've got a terabyte drive, that's a tad more than $1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my concern, and that's exactly why I've become more interested that over the last 12 to 15 years, all these digital photographs are very fragile, let me put it that way.
And so
that's why I wanted to make sure all the backup was being done.
Yeah. And you mentioned RAID, and a lot of people mistakenly think RAID is a backup. It's not. RAID is a mirror, the one primary RAID, where it writes the same data to two drives. So if one drive mechanically fails, all your data is on the second drive. But it's not a backup, because if you delete something, it's deleted from both drives. If a file is corrupted, it's corrupted on both drives.
If something happens to the machine that RAID array is in, it could affect both drives. That's not backup. So my suggestion for a general policy is get a decent on-network storage, like a LaCie drive or one of those, that's connected to your network, and all your machines can back up to it. Set up a script that backs them up regularly, every day, for example. And then secondarily, find an online backup solution that you like and use that as well. Okay. If there's stuff and that's for stuff you really want to save. I mean, if you've got a folder of emails to Aunt Minnie, maybe you don't care. Right? But baby pictures you care about, your thesis you care about. Nothing breaks my heart more than people come with their flash drives and say, I can't read my flash drive and my thesis is on it. And my first question is, where's your backup? And 99% of the time, I don't have one.
Nobody told me I needed one.
Nobody told me I needed one. You need one. Everybody, listen, everybody out there, you need a backup. That's a given. And in terms of what are you going to buy, these days, most of the products that are left on the market are in pretty good quality. So what really counts is the warranty. If something comes with a 1-year warranty and something else comes with a 3-year warranty, go with the 3-year warranty.
It might cost a little bit more, but it's worth it.
It's worth it. And be aware that in 3 years, maybe you start thinking about replacing that thing. I'm sorry, there's no magic anymore. I know everybody wants to keep their machines for 20 years, but you can't. Get over yourself. It's like, well, my car, I've had it for 20 years, and the floors have all rusted out, so you can't ride with me. But I can still drive it. Now, how am I going to carry 10 people? Well, you're not anymore. Get over it. You're just not. You can have a 20-year-old car, but you can't carry 10 people. Same thing with a 10-year-old or 20-year-old computer. It's not going to work the way a new one does, and it may not even be fixable anymore.
And computer years.
By the average user.
Computer years are like 20 to 1. You know, they say dog years are 6 to 1. Computer years are like 20 to 1. So a 1-year-old computer is like 20 human years old.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Would you then recommend that there be at least 2 to 3 external hard drives that you're swapping in and out, as Dave mentioned, so that you do the backup on all 3 and then begin?
Well, some people like to do that and then rotate one offsite themselves.
Yeah,
we see it a lot in businesses where it's much more critical that you have multiple backup copies.
But in general, the suggestion is 1 network-attached storage device and 1 off-site storage device, because we are all human, and therefore you will skip changing that drive out and getting it off-site the one day it matters.
And the network-attached storage is handy so that every computer on your network, desktop, laptops, can all back up to a single drive.
Right. And then that offsite storage means if anything disastrous, God forbid, happens to your home, you've still got the storage somewhere else.
And then that one of the side effects of most of the offsite storage companies is that you have a web interface, and say you're away from home and need a file, you log into your backup, and there's your file.
Yep.
That's what I love about G Drive.
Google Drive, yep. Exactly. Exactly.
Except you have to write your own script to do automated backup to G Drive. Or you have to remember to copy the files yourself.
Does Time Machine do offsite backup?
No.
That's an oversight on their part, I think. Anyway, that's the deal. Our suggestion is one locally attached, network-attached storage device and a good offsite backup on the internet. That's, so it's easy mm-hmm. and convenient, and once you set it up, you can forget about it forever until you need it.
That's often called the 3-2-1 backup solution. You have three copies of your data on two different media, and one of them should be offsite.
Right.
Great. Okay.
There you go.
Thanks.
Thank
you, gentlemen.
We're going to take another break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, and we are right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
This is Rob Linton. Join me this afternoon from 4:30 till 6 for Saturday Swing, only on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we have Joe from Chicktawaga, New York, on the line. Hiya, Joe. What do you know?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I have six generations of backups. I basically take one of those large USB attached drives, you know, 2 terabytes each, and partition them out for a backup for each of my systems.
Nice.
Three generations on each disk, so therefore six total.
Right.
And, of course, hard disks unfortunately fail, the main primary ones and your backup ones sometimes.
Yep.
But usually not at the same time. Usually.
Hopefully not.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
But again, those are both local, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. What I really should be doing is rotating them with, say, put one of them at my mom's house, and in case my place burns down or gets flooded or whatever,
yeah,
you can have something to work from.
Yeah. You can also get fire safes. There's a big safe company in town that makes fire safes.
There's a company called IO Safe that yep. makes a hard drive that you can drop in the water, dance on, set fire to yep. with a blowtorch, and all the data are still safe.
Sentry
it's an
safe.
Amazing product.
Sentry Safes has a couple of those, too.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing when you're looking at a safe, you got to make sure it's data rated, because most safes are only rated for paper, not data. So you don't want your disk platters to melt,
right.
which apparently is a lot lower than 451 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. IO Safe is an actual hard drive product.
Yeah.
So it's just ridiculously nice. But, yeah, you need to be off-site, though, Joe. That's important. And you know, most people get lazy. They will skip taking it out. Or, I just finished updating. I'll take it out tomorrow, and then tonight's the night something happens. So that's why I also believe in on-site, off-site storage, online backup, I mean.
I also take complete backups. My reasoning is that if I miss, you know, I'll say, only do my /home, or only /home my username.
Right.
Okay, then the second I go and accidentally delete something that's outside of that directory tree, oh, crap, where am I going to get that from now?
Yep.
Right.
I always fear missing something in my backup. You might also want to consider every once in a while using something like CloneZilla, or
right.
True Image or something like that, so that there's not a whole lot of work to do if something does fail. I mean, think of your typical thing is your hard disk is going clink, clink, clink.
Yep.
So you buy a new hard drive, it's an awful lot of work to do an OS installation and all that, whereas if you had a CloneZilla image, all you have to do is boot CloneZilla, get out your media that has your CloneZilla image, and restore from that, and you should have a bootable computer within, say, 10 minutes to an hour, depending on how much data you have to restore.
Right. Yeah, you can have a fast backup, which is just your data, but then there's a long time to restore, the OS, the updates, the apps, the updates, then your data. Or you can have a longer backup, where you back up everything on your computer, but then that gives you a much faster restore. So,
oh, yeah,
so you can pick whether you want a fast backup or a fast restore.
Right.
But the other thing that I'll throw in here, the monkey wrench, is is usually if it crashes, it could, you know, and it's been quite a while. I know it's a pain in the butt and it takes the time, but sometimes taking the effort just to do a fresh install and maybe just the programs that you want, because over time you might have installed and uninstalled so many different programs, and if you didn't use a program, say like Revo Uninstaller, that registry is pretty big.
Yeah.
And if you do a restore, that big registry is still there versus doing it fresh.
There's also the fact that a lot of backup programs don't always back up hidden folders. And, Joe, you need to check that as to whether or not you're actually backing up hidden folders.
Good point.
Standard copy won't do it. Xcopy may not do it. Rsync may not do it. What?
Well, I use Rsync with the extended attributes and ACLs options, so...
Yeah, there's probably a flag.
Pretty much covered. There's a few files that I can't back up, because it's not useful to back them up, like the LVM, the Logical Volume Manager information.
Right.
If I redo my system, that's going to be absolutely useless. So I do have a few excludes in there, but only for stuff like that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can't remember, it was a couple months ago, I think it was, that YouTube started doing the same thing in regards to commenting on videos. You're supposed to, it had this JavaScript pop-up that said, here, you have your login name, but use your real name now. And, like, if you have a Google Plus account that's linked, it'll say, well, you could use, Joe, won't say my last name.
Right.
That was kind of interesting and annoying, too. It's like, okay, so you've been known for one name online, and you use it on YouTube, and everybody knows you by that, but all of a sudden, oh, you're going to change your identity. I mean, the thing about, there was a big discussion when Google Plus went up first, too, that, you know, oh, why should I have to use my real name? You know, it could be, you know, potentially dangerous, you know, being attacked in real life or doing stuff online, that sort of thing. And it's like, okay, let's see if you people can know who Stephanie Germanotta is.
Right.
Yeah, nobody knows. Most people know her as Lady Gaga.
Right.
So.
Right, and I get all of that, but you know, the there's two sides of that story. The reason that Google put out for doing that on YouTube was that so many comments are just so horribly lame or racist or just stupid that their hope was if people were forced to use their real names, they would be less racist, less stupid, less...
Yeah, that feeling of anonymity because it's at the other end of the computer.
Right. Make them accountable.
But you're absolutely right. The downside of that, the dark side of that is if you're being stalked, if you're being, you know, if you've got an abusive ex... you really don't want your real name out there under any set of circumstances. I get that.
Mm, yeah, it's just problematic all around either way you go, really.
And what about celebrities? How many of them are well known for their stage name because their real name was already used by somebody, so they had to change their name?
That's right.
How many Michael Douglases are there? So Michael Keaton is Michael Douglas.
That's right. That's exactly right. Actually, the other way around.
Is it the other way around?
Yeah. Michael Keaton's real name is Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
Only there was already a Michael Douglas. Yep. You may have heard of him. So there couldn't be two in the Actors Guild. Yep. So he had to pick, I think it's his mother's maiden name.
Something like
Michael
that.
Keaton.
David Tennant, his name is McDonald, is it?
So, yeah.
Something like that. Now, how many McDonald's are there in Scotland?
Right,
All of them.
And there were already David McDonald's in the union. So, yeah. No, I get it. And so it becomes completely problematic all the way around. But one of the things that at least Google said they were going for was to prevent the kind of abuse that anonymity often causes. Whether or not
that all the time.
Right. It's like the old XKCD program. The guy wrote a macro that would read back to you your YouTube comment. And then they show some guy actually using it, and then he goes to sit in the front steps and says, I'm a moron. I didn't know.
Yeah. Did you see the giant XKCD picture the other day?
Oh, my heavens.
Did you download the whole thing?
Of course I did. I found the whales. I found the X-Fighter. I found the giant jellyfish.
Yep. They're still finding stuff.
They're still
finding
stuff.
I went back to explain XKCD, and they're still finding
stuff. XKCD is a cartoon on the it's a webcomic, and it's at xkcd.org, and I'm pretty sure it's xkcd.org. Steve's going to look it up right
.com.
Now.
.com.
.com? Okay.
Probably both.
Probably both. And they put out a picture every week at stick figures. And this last Friday, I guess it was, he put out a panel that was just three regular panels of stick figures. And then the fourth one goes on forever. It's a series of 2048 by 2048 stitched together panels. It's just ginormous, and it's amazing. It's an amazing picture.
He must have been working on that forever.
Well, that's what I was thinking, too. How long did it take him to do that? Because it's all black and white drawings. And you go way up in the air, and then you go way down underground as well. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stuff.
Well, I only saw a small fraction of it because I haven't looked at it on my desktop.
Yeah.
But I first saw that on my little 7-inch tablet, and I'm wiping across the screen seemingly forever.
Yeah, and you do. You scroll forever. So a couple people have stitched the whole thing together. There are half a dozen places that say they've got the whole thing, and they've got about a third of it. But there are a couple places that apparently have the whole thing, and you can tell because at one end, at each end, it says something along the lines of, this is as far as we can go, or I wish we could go further, or what'll happen next time, sort of thing. So it's astonishing. It's astonishing. And you have to quarter the whole thing to see, you know, what all the pieces and parts are.
The Wikipedia, or the Explain XKCD Wiki, we're at 0.5% zoom to fit on the screen.
Yeah.
0.5% zoom.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty amazing stuff. All right, thanks, Joe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have fun. In terms of backup, I understand what he's saying. That's just a matter of personal preference. I would prefer, if my machine crashes, to reinstall clean and then just restore all my data. But then you have to worry about making sure all your data are, in fact, backed up. And I get that. I do. I actually have my home folder on a separate drive, so it's a kind of a different thing. But if you're not backing up, you should be. You should be. That's important. And multiple backups are equally important. And regular backups, regular multiple backups are what save your data. Now, if you don't care about your data, that's fine. But it's kind of silly to not spend a few bucks to make sure your data are backed up and then instead complain to your local vendor when they say, well, it's going to cost you $200 for us to get your data back. It's ridiculous.
Or $1,000 or more.
Oh, well, or $1,000 or more.
Like Steve was saying, you were saying before, you know, how you send it to one of these companies and it's over $1,000, and sometimes just for them to look at it.
Right.
You know. And we had a couple times where folks, we tell them, you know, what it's going to cost because we've got the tools. I've spent the money on the software to get a lot of this stuff back. And they go, oh, that's totally ridiculous. I go, okay.
Well,
fine.
And that's even without the clean room, which is the next step up where you physically take the drive apart.
Yeah.
Right.
And they get all bent out of shape and it's like, excuse me.
So spend $100 on a backup drive.
Right, yeah. Exactly right, and that's the big thing. You know, you're not willing to spend the money at either end, then you're not going to get your data back. It's that simple. Yeah. There's no magic here.
I did have one come back. I think they wanted to wait a while because it was like a month and a half later, and they pretended they were coming in as a new customer.
Oh, very nice. Like you've got Alzheimer's, and you're not going to remember.
I was born at night, just not last night.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know if they thought they were going to get another deal or anything else, and we told them, all right.
I want a second opinion from the same person.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, it gets tedious. And, I mean, we've had one drive, and it kept failing. So we've got a few tricks that it took us close to 4 days. Because the machine, you know, we get the drive and boot it up and then get it up, and we could have it running for maybe a half hour. It got down to maybe 15 minutes. And then we grab what we could, and we had to repeat our procedure, bring it back out, get it back up, running, you know, like I say, anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes, grab what we could. 4 or 5 days of that, that's time.
My record is 3 months. Wow. Sitting away, grinding on a drive, and got everything back after 3 months.
Yep.
No. Yeah, we've done it. And I mean, even when somebody's overwritten other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and can you get it back? Yeah, we can. You know, as long as you didn't do anything else to it. You know, it didn't format it. If you just erased it, yeah, there's a good chance we can get a lot of that stuff back. But again, it's not cheap.
Right.
And I guess we have to kick people in the chops there a little bit, you know, to bring them down to reality that it's costly. If you don't believe us, call one of those places up. And I think that's what the individual did. And once they found out, okay, we'll come back to you.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a when we sell a new computer, we always talk about backup drives. And we have a line item in our system that says declined backup drive. So when they come back and say, you didn't tell me that, and we can, well, here it is on your receipt that you declined the backup drive.
Yeah, I mean,
yep.
You can only do so much for folks. And, you know, I understand, you know, sometimes they can't afford to do this or that. But all boils down to how important is the data to you? If you lose it, is it going to be earth-shattering? You know, like you said before, Steve, those pictures, that, you know, of the grandkids and everything else that, you know, you're going to regret? Or do you want to spend a few bucks or even just get a flash drive?
All drives will fail eventually.
Yeah.
You may not have lost data yet, but you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you need to have a backup.
Yep. Yep. It's ridiculous to not do it that way. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. If you're on the phone, please stay on the phone. We will get back to you when we come back. It is 39 minutes after the hour. If you're not on the phone, I don't know why not. We're just having more fun than you can imagine. So call in and join in. You know how to do that. It's 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Back in just a couple of minutes with Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we have George from Greece on the line. Welcome, George. What's your question?
Fellas, I'm doing a backup. I do it every week as I listen to you.
Excellent. That's good way to do that.
I happen to use 3 thumb drives, and I rotate through them. I can get 2 weeks onto one drive. So it allows me to cycle through there in the course of about 6 weeks or so.
Nice.
But interesting thing I've come across, maybe you can help me out. I have laptop with a 30-gig hard drive, and I've intentionally kept it to a smaller size so that it makes me pay attention to what I'm keeping.
Right.
And go through and do some housekeeping. And I find that my Windows file has grown from about 6 gig to 8 gig over a course of probably many months, maybe even a year. And I'm looking further, and it's loaded with subfiles that I don't recognize. And they read as follows. $NT service pack.
Yep.
Uninstalled.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I was going to guess.
And there's hundreds of them in there, maybe 200 or 300.
Yep. Every update that you install for Microsoft, it keeps the old uninstaller, so you can uninstall that update. On the theory that if something goes wrong, you can then uninstall it and get back to where you were.
Okay.
If you go into the disk cleanup utility, right-click on your hard drive and choose properties and then tools. One of the options in disk cleanup is to delete all those uninstallers. The problem then is you can't uninstall a service pack or patch if you ever need to. But if your computer's working fine, it's probably safe to delete those uninstallers.
Right.
So if I understand what you're saying, after some reasonable period of time, like a day or two or a week, if I haven't had a problem, I'm probably not going to need to uninstall it.
You got it.
So I ought to just clean those right out of there fairly regularly.
Yep-er.
Okay, now I found something else in there that surprised me. There's a file showed up called Recycler. It's in caps, R-E-C-Y-C-L-E-R. And underneath that are two files, fairly large, on the order of 1.5 gig. And it is loaded with copies of numerous other files that I have been backing up in the past.
That's the contents of the recycle bin, isn't it?
Yeah, except that there is a bug in which it may not, in fact, remove items from the recycle bin. Microsoft support knows about this.
Article 229041.
Yep. Yep, that's exactly it. They tend to blame it on third-party things, but if you go into Recycler and change to your user thing, you can just del star.star them.
From a command line?
Yeah.
Are you suggesting I do it while we're talking?
No, because we have too many people on the line to wait, but... that's what Microsoft suggests as the solution. I've never done it myself.
And I've posted that link on our website.
But I can't just delete these two files under the cycle.
No, you want to keep the files, but those two subfolders. Let's be clear what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the recycle folder or any folders under it.
No,
I'm talking about the files inside those folders. If they are folders, do not delete them. If they are files, you can delete them.
Let me just go one step further. Under this folder recycler, there is a file S-1-5-21 and then many, many other numerals. And when I open that, it is numerous files that I recognize that are my working files that I have tried to back up.
That folder is probably the date the files were deleted.
When you say open it, you mean you're opening it with a text editor?
No, I've just gone down through...
Then it's not a file, it's a folder.
Yeah, I said folder is recycler.
Right, and under that is another folder.
You're correct.
Thank you. As I said, do not delete the folders, but you can delete the files that are inside those folders.
Now, there's folders within that subfolder also.
It's only the two main ones that are important.
Okay.
Okie doke.
And what's the caution for not deleting those?
Because Windows expects to see them there. It may recreate them, but it may throw an error.
I see. So I'll go to work on the Windows file first, or Windows folder first.
Sure.
To get rid of all of those installs.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yep-er.
Bye.
Yeah, it's supposed to, when you empty the recycle bin, it's supposed to delete all those files. Sometimes it doesn't.
Well, it's Windows.
On the Mac, you sometimes get an error message that the file is in use.
Yes.
And that's often a temp file that a program left open. Usually, if you quit the program, it'll work. Or if you restart the computer, it'll work. It was such a big problem that I think it was starting in Lion, you can now force empty the trash, even if the file says it's in use. But be really careful about doing that, because it may be a file you're using.
Well, exactly. All right, our next caller is Dick from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dick. What's your question?
My problem is that every time I try to download Mountain Lion, it says connection failed.
Yeah, Mountain Lion is about 4.5 gigabytes to download. On a typical broadband connection, it will take 6 or 7 hours. So you need to be able to maintain your connection for that long. Are you using a wired or wireless connection on your computer?
Wireless connection from Frontier.
Try plugging an Ethernet wire into your Frontier router and see if that helps. Wireless is a radio signal, and it can fluctuate. There can be interference. Someone turns the microwave on in the kitchen, and that puts out enough of an interference to make the line hiccup. If you're looking at a website, you may not notice there's a little hiccup in the the transmission.
And both Windows and Apple hide short breaks from you.
Yeah.
But when you're downloading something, they can't.
If the break is too long, then it gives up trying to download that one giant file.
Right.
And how long does it take with an Ethernet connection or a wired connection?
Well, it should be the same time, wired or wireless. It's all dependent on your internet service. We have seen 6 or 7 hours on standard Frontier internet service.
The difference becomes when you're wired, there's no likelihood that turning on the microwave or anything else will break that connection momentarily because it's hardwired now.
So if I took it someplace, would the various stores have connections that would download quicker?
With faster wireless, it may only take 3 or 4 hours. It's over 4 gigabytes in size. Apple used to sell with the Lion upgrade, you could buy a flash drive. It was $70 for the flash drive, so $30 for the OS and then $40 for the flash drive. A little expensive. It's an itty-bitty little tiny flash drive, which is why it was expensive.
Well, no, it has the Apple logo on it.
It has the Apple logo on it,
there's
too,
$25.
But they
right
don't
there
do that for Mountain Lion.
Yeah, I bought that, and, it's like a thumbnail.
It's so tiny. Yeah, so for people that don't have high enough speed internet, you can, and a laptop, you can take your laptop into an Apple store and use their internet. At least I've heard you can do that. I haven't done it myself. But, it still may take 3 or 4 hours because it's over 4 gigabytes. Theoretically, it will resume itself. If you go back into the App Store, you can resume the download and it should pick up where it left off. But you may have to keep doing that if you have disconnects.
So that's most likely the problem. There's not some complicated thing about my...
Probably not. If you were trying to do it in the last couple of days, iOS 6 came out, and then macOS 10.8.2 came out, and so that there were three really huge updates that came out in the last week.
No, I've been doing it over the last month.
Yeah, so everything has been slow downloading from Apple in the last couple of days because 200 million people are downloading iOS 6.
But the reality is it's just a ginormous file, and consequently it's going to be very, very hard on a typical home connection, particularly if you're wireless, to get it. If you connect yourself wired and let it run overnight, the theory is it should work.
Now, could I ask this question?
Sure.
Why don't they sell it on a thumb drive for me?
We asked.
Sorry. I mean, all right.
Well, yeah, we asked a couple people that. They also stopped selling all of their boxed software, and it's only downloadable. The short answer is it costs more. There's manufacturing costs, there's design costs, there's distribution costs, there's the cost of putting it on the shelf. You know, and if you're in retail, you realize there's cost for all of that. So they can save all that cost by just making it a download.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. That's a real problem. If you're somewhere like, say, at RIT, which has gigabit connectivity
to
most
here
desktops and multi gigabit, multi terabyte connectivity to the internet, it becomes less of a problem. But when you're in a home situation, you've got 3 gig, 4 gig, 6 gig, 10 gig,
gigabit.
So you multiply that by 8. And then by the size of the thing, and that tells you how long it's going to take. It's ridiculous.
So you may get 1 megabit per second or 1 megabyte per second download speed on a 10 megabit line, and you're trying to download 4,000 megabytes. So that's 4,000 minutes if you're getting full speed.
Right. So it becomes it becomes an issue of math, and that's all there is to it. And there's no way to overcome that. I do agree that Apple should continue to sell these things. They're a publicly traded company, so they're less interested in your convenience than in their bottom line, and that's what that's about. But I agree with you that they should still continue to think at least a little bit about their folks. Listen, we are done for another week. I want to thank each and every one of you called in. I want to apologize to all those of you who called in the last 10 minutes and didn't get on. I am sorry. Call earlier next week, please. We only, we're limited into one call at a time. But we will be here next Saturday, starting at noon. So call in early and often, and we'll be back with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and all of you on the longest running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites. George is coming in with Linda. Linda keeps him in on track, but George will be bringing you the best German music you will hear all week. So stay tuned for some of that good stuff. And we'll be back next week with Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.